Imagine the world's greatest flying machine, 777 feet long. That's longer than two football fields, an object larger in volume than the Titanic. Its much heralded first voyage would be from London to India and arrive in just 4 days. It's 1930, and the R101 is the jewel of a British empire stretching across the globe. Its only enemy? A bad thunderstorm. Oh, and that it could blow up. From KERA in Dallas, I'm Paige Phelps in for Chris Boyd. In an age when flying was still largely experimental and commercial flights were dangerous, uncomfortable, and arduous, there were 51 crashes in 1929 alone. The Zeppelin flying machine looked like a viable alternative. It was smooth sailing with appointed luxuries, a smoking lounge, fine china. It promised to connect the world with style and grace, all powered by bags of highly flammable hydrogen gas hovering above passenger heads. But in an age just after the Great War, when once unimaginable killing machines changed what bravery looked like, floating beneath a steerable, sparkable balloon seemed like a manageable risk. Until it wasn't. Author S.C. Gwynn writes about a great ship called the R101, which sought to change flight forever, heralding in a new age of opportunity and technology, and the bombastic men who shepherded it towards a doomed future. His book is His Majesty's Airship, The Life and Tragic Death of the World's Largest Flying Machine. Sam, welcome back to Think.
It is great to be back here.
You start this book by saying this is a ship of empire. What do you mean by that?
So R101 was part of a scheme evolved by people in the British government to essentially populate the world with airships, that the world would be linked. And the reason they were doing that was because after World War I, Britain came out of it weakened in many ways, but except that they now held the largest empire in the history of the world. They held 25% of the world's landmass. They held 420 million people. And so they had this giant empire, even though they were very wobbly. The American star was ascendant. The British star, you know, British Empire was being, assaulted in various places, you know, from South Africa to Ireland to India to Iraq. And they evolved a plan. This was sort of these new empire men evolved a plan that was to sort of take this giant empire and link it together through the air. And not only that, but it was going to be linked through this advanced British technology. They were just going to build airships bigger than anybody had built them before. And they were going to be able to go, you know, when you look at the compression of time and distance, for example, well, you just said to India instead of 2 weeks, 4 days, to Australia instead of a month in 11 days. I mean, we're talking radical compression of the space-time continuum. I mean, it suddenly everything was closer. And so this was the background of the book. The idea was, it was called the Imperial Airship Scheme. And the book is about the men that came up with it, and the book is about how it went horribly wrong.
Yeah, I think it's right there in the title. It's not a
secret. Spoiler.
No. No, you said these were equal parts engineering and ideology.
Right. So part of the oddity, I guess, or the mystery of airships is that they were really never very good. They were never a very good idea. They crashed all the time. They were too big. They were too vulnerable to wind. You couldn't maneuver them to the ground. They couldn't go down in a storm. They blew up because of the hydrogen. Very difficult to navigate. Imagine a 6-acre surface area and then a 50-mile-an-hour wind hit it. I mean, if you've ever sailed a sunfish and you see what a big wind does, how about now try 6 acres? So these things were, so that one of the questions, why did they persist? And they persisted for about 40 years. It was the length of the airship era. But they shouldn't have even persisted that long. And one of the reasons was that somehow they inspired this kind of nationalistic pride, this kind of, nationalistic pride is the best way to put it, starting in Germany and then kind of migrating to Great Britain and then to the United States. There was just something about the technological challenge, the sheer size of these things, which was just so much bigger than anything anyone had seen. And somehow they became associated, I guess, with the national character, national spirit, national pride.
I think we need to do some housekeeping here. Mm-hmm. An airship is not a blimp.
No. Okay, so an air. So this book is about a thing called a rigid airship, or the phenomenon of rigid airships. So when we say HAR R101, it's rigid R101. So what's a rigid airship? I have to go back to the 19th century, or actually before that. In the 18th century, the balloon was invented. So you could put hot air into it, or you could put hydrogen into it, and it would go up, which in a world governed by gravity where everything else went down was kind of a miracle. The problem with the balloon is you couldn't steer it. It would just go up and would go wherever God or the wind wanted it to go. And its best use, perhaps, was as a military observation balloon, used that way in the American Civil War and the Crimean War. You tethered it to the ground, you put it up, and you could see down. But they had this problem. Okay, in the 19th century, the French sort of improved it. They put a rudder on it and a propeller. And this became the first airship. And it was a steerable airship. In fact, the French verb to steer or direct is diriger, and the something that could be steered or directed was a dirigeable, right? Excuse my French accent, but so that's what it was. The problem with a balloon or a blimp, which is really the same thing, they're something that you inflate. There's no structure to it really. On a blimp, there may be a bottom keel, but you know, if you take the air out of it, it deflates. The problem with these balloons or blimps is that you could only build them so big and they would start to collapse upon themselves, and therefore you could only lift a certain amount because you could only lift however much was in the gas that, you know, the hydrogen gas that was doing the lifting. And so this marvelous gentleman named Count Ferdinand von Zeppelin in the year 1900 invented the first rigid airship. And what that was a giant metal skeleton with huge transverse rings and longitudinal girders inside of which were these big hydrogen gas bags. And the whole point was to be able to lift more. And these things, they were funny looking. They looked like giant pencils. They were over 400 feet long. Nobody had ever seen anything like them. And it was the beginning of, the word became introduced to European languages in the early 1900s, the word Zeppelin. That's what they were called.
And I think, too, now in fourth grade, I did a science fair project showing Bernoulli's principle about the mechanics of flight. Okay, mm-hmm. Now I got a C on that.
Yes.
So I do want to revisit how airships fly.
Right.
So how do they get lift?
Okay, so airships fly mainly, they fly in two ways. However much, let's say, one of these big airships weighs, if you add everything together and you put enough gas in it, it will float in equilibrium, just the way, you know, a helium balloon would be, you know, with a toothpick attached to it. And once they're in equilibrium, if you put a propeller behind it and you can move it mm-hmm. forward and move it around, and you can move it up and you can move it down using the elevators.
The elevators.
The big elevators,
yes.
On the back. Huge, gigantic. I mean, these in the R101, I mean, they were absolutely, you know, five stories high on the back. Anyway, the elevators, the flaps, you could make it go up and down. But it could also, the ship could also fly, and this would become relevant if, for example, it rained and the airship became heavier. You could stick its nose up a little bit and make it fly like an airplane, make it fly with Bernoulli's principle, which became important, again, if the weight of the airship fluctuated. So it was two things. It could be what they called an aerostat, you know, that could just hover in the air. It could also fly like an airplane.
And the ballast. Can you explain the ballast?
And the ballast. And so really, so those, the fundamental way you made it go up was through the helium, or the hydrogen, or the helium later. The ships also carried up to 10% of their total weight in ballast. And what the ballast would allow you to do, when it would save you from a fall, if you were falling in an airship toward the ground, you could blow the water ballast or fuel ballast and save yourself. It was also the way to equalize the pressure. I mean, on some level, the airship did have to kind of float weightlessly in the air. And so by valving hydrogen gas or dropping ballast, you could arrive at this moment of kind of equilibrium where it could sit and float.
So this was not an easy ship to fly.
unbelievably difficult, and way, as I go into in my book in some detail, way more difficult than flying an airplane.
Yeah, and there were several. It's not just a pilot and a co-pilot. This was truly a ship. How many crew was needed to take and run this thing?
So if you had one of the big ones, you'd be looking at about 40 normally, 40 crew, and you had, you know, a height coxswain who looked at where the ship was going up and down, and then the directional coxswain that pointed it one way or the other. And they had to worry about all kinds of things that affected the lift, because the hydrogen in there, it was not a static thing. In other words, it depended on air density and humidity and barometric pressure and all these things, purity of the hydrogen, which affected the amount of lift. In fact, the higher an airship went, the more lift it lost.
And to figure out altitude, sometimes they dropped highly flammable flares.
They would calcium flares into the ocean. They would also shoot. They had this. They had a gun that they would shoot through a pipe, through a tube, and they would sort of listen to hear how long it took for the echo to come back. I mean, this is pretty primitive stuff. Although there was also some very, very sophisticated stuff inside these things.
Well, and here's my question. What are gold beaters? This one blew my mind.
So the airship, the rigid airships were a strange combination of strong and extremely light and vulnerable. The strong was presumably the steel skeleton of the thing. And the weak points, there were two of them. One was the outer cover, which was cotton or linen, doped by, which means you put some chemical on it basically to try to make it waterproof. But just thin, just think of a thin piece of linen, not very thick at all, wrapping the airship. And inside that, you had these gas bags. On R101, the biggest of them were 10 stories high. They were made of cattle intestines. Which seems implausible, and why would you use cattle intestines? And the reason was that the German scientists, back when the early days of the Zeppelins, were trying to find something that was impermeable. Hydrogen is the lightest element, and it wherever you put it, it gets out. And when I say cattle intestines, think sausage casings. It's a sausage casing. In this case, the cecum, which was a part of the cattle intestine, is about 12 inches square, 14 inches square. And they required 500,000 of these, by the way, to build R101. But these, say, they would put a light cotton backing on it. And this was the most impermeable thing they could find in the universe at the time. Later, Goodyear figured out a way to do some rubberized cotton, but for more than 30 years, it was the only way. And so these women at Cardington, north of London, where they assembled the airship, you know, they would get these raw, you know, intestines in from Argentine slaughterhouses, and they smelled to high heaven, and they would scrape the blood and mucus off and then cure it here and then glue it together and then put some cotton on it. And these things were so weak you could put your finger through them. Tools were constantly falling through them. Workmen were falling through them. And yet, these were the things that held, well, in this case, that one 10-story bag I told you about, gas bag in R101, held 500,000 cubic feet of hydrogen. And hydrogen is not something you just kind of wanted out mixing with air. You didn't really want that.
We have not gotten to the luxurious appointments inside this flying machine, this airship. Heated passenger cabins, dance music, sherry, and my favorite, a smoking lounge.
Yeah. That's everyone's favorite.
How did that not blow up?
So this ship was not only meant to reinvent air travel in the sense that you could fly long distances around the world and do it comfortably and do it fast. And not because, by the way, the airship was fast, but because it didn't need to stop to refuel. So going from London to India was a one-stopper in Egypt. So you could just keep droning on at 65 miles an hour up there. Anyway, so that was supposed to do that. But it was also supposed to offer a level of luxury just unknown to air travel, because airplanes, as the airship people say, heavier than aircraft, were notoriously uncomfortable, bumpy, noisy, messy. You'd get splattered with oil. I mean, they were, well, they crashed all the time too, but I mean, they were absolutely not comfortable, and they're not really built for the long range travel. So here these guys come along and they say, no, we've got this great thing. And it kind of, they made it to look kind of like a cross between a Pullman car, like a luxurious old train car, and like an admiral's quarters on a steamship. And it had, you know, gold-trimmed pillars and an elaborate dining room set with Cambridge blue china and a cocktail lounge, a promenade with a large window that you could see out, and of course the smoking lounge, which no one had ever put on in the air before. And one of the interesting things about the luxury was that it was all illusion, because in the world of lighter than air, you can't have a lot of weight. And so when you look at the dining room, you think, wow, this looks really luxurious, you know. And the pillars are made of balsa wood. The walls, which you would think were plaster when you first, are linen, one-ply linen, ultralight aluminum balsa wood. Everything's an illusion. The wicker chairs are ultralight, and so there's no substance to it, even though it looks really good. But that was one of the big things they were selling, and one of the reasons they believed that everybody was going to want to fly this way around the world.
So I want to talk about an R101 major player now, Major George Herbert Scott, a decorated veteran. He had a press-on, regardless attitude. But in 1930, he was known more for his recklessness and for something else. What was that?
For his drinking. Yeah. Let me tell you about Herbert Scott. He was a great hero. He was one of the greatest heroes in aviation history. And he's been forgotten. And I'll give you a little background before we go back to Scott being kind of in charge of this ship on the night it went down, a known alcoholic. So we go back to World War One, where the Germans were flying Zeppelins and were bombing the hell out of Europe and particularly England with these Zeppelins. They were the first long-range bombers, the first weapons of mass terror, and so forth. Anyway, the British tried to imitate the German Zeppelins, but they couldn't. The best they could do is when one of them went down, the British engineers would swarm over it and try to figure out how it worked, and then they'd go back and they would eventually kind of come up with a version of it, but years behind. Anyway, the war, and Britain only came up with 7 in the war. They were not really even, none of them were operational. The Germans built 150. And so we come out of the war now, and Britain has got they've got an airship. And this airship that they imitated, the Germans built these height climbers to get away from the British fighters, and they could go way up and go fast. And the British had this Zeppelin knockoff. And they had what they perceived to be a great pilot in Herbert Scott. So in 1919, this is after World War One is over, and the British are trying to figure out what to do with this airship. They decide, let's fly the Atlantic, which is a completely ridiculous idea. The machine that they had has no business trying to do that. And in fact, you know, it created all sorts of trouble for them. But they then proceed to fly it east-west across the Atlantic. It's the first east-west crossing. It's only the second crossing of any kind, but the first east-west. East-west is the hard way. Lindbergh went the easy way. They go east-west, and then they turned around, and they came back to England, and it was the first double crossing. Okay, this is 8 years before Lindbergh. I mean, George Herbert Scott is a national hero. And the public did not understand exactly how dangerous what he did really was. It was as dangerous as what Lindbergh did. And the only reason I can think of is why we all don't know that name is because Lindbergh kind of overrode it. Lindbergh overrode a lot of things. I mean, the phenomenon of his crossing, but also the explosion of aircraft travel. Anyway, your question is, so Scott, meanwhile, he doesn't, not a lot for him to do after this. And he kind of falls into kind of a drinking syndrome where he goes out with his buddies at lunch and then they just kind of keep drinking. But his status never changed. And on this fateful night, October 4th, 1930, when R101 left for India, it would never make it there. I mean, he had this kind of outsized role in calling. He had the go, no-go call on it. He should never have had that. And he also had confused the actual authority of himself and the captain of the ship. But it became one of the many problems of R101.
And he was slurring his words.
Yeah, at the moment of takeoff, yes.
And then he was drinking sherry on the...
And then he was. Then they were all having dinner, and that went on till midnight, and yes. And this is the man who has... And taking off into a storm, which it did, the go-no-go call becomes really the key call. If the person who can say, no, actually, we really shouldn't cross the English Channel. Let's stop. That would have been his call. He would have been drunk.
I want to get to why the no-go call would never have been made. But first, I think we need to step back for a sec and talk about the after the R-34, which you were talking
that
about.
That was the one that crossed the Atlantic.
We have R-34. The R-38.
Right.
Now, this was a ship that the R-101 was modeled after, but not for the reasons that you would think. This is not a successful ship.
So coming out of the war, the Germans flew a lot of Zeppelins during the war. They flew a lot of raids. It was a terrible idea. Most of those things went down in hydrogen fireballs that looked just like the Hindenburg. And so coming out of the war, the British had these ambitions, though. They still, again, this kind of national pride, this idea that, no, we can do this, and we can do this as well or better than the Germans. And R-34, the double crossing of the Atlantic, that was the first thing. And then in 1921, they came up with R-38, again, R for rigid airship, and this was going to be the biggest and best thing. And in fact, it was the big. It was loaded with new technology. It was based on Zeppelins, but it had new British technology, and it was a complete disaster. It was yet another hydrogen fireball, and it was just basically incompetence in the construction of it, overconfidence in what it could do, and the lessons of, and really after all these Zeppelins, most of the Zeppelins had gone down in World War I because of combat in one way or the other. And so, but coming out of the war, the crashes that happened, and there were a whole bunch of them, crashes of American airships and British airships, were not related to combat. And so the lessons of R-38, you would have thought, were that, don't try this. Yeah. This is too difficult. And this is why it's just kind of bizarre that in 1924, 1925, just at this moment when it really seems like airships are, their time is over, they haven't performed, they're not practical, they blow up all the time, they're so vulnerable to wind, you can't maneuver them near the ground, it's a very bad idea, basically. And so in the mid-20s, this is the moment when Lord Christopher Birdwood Thompson, the Secretary of State for Air of the British Empire, decides to launch the Great Imperial Airship Scheme. So and at that particular moment, there's only one airship flying in the world. So it's an odd moment. We're going to take this gigantic ambition in spite of all of the evidence, which should have suggested that you can't do that.
I was having trouble with the logic of airship building because they do blow up. Go down. There's so many disasters and they kept going. And then I thought about the sheer mettle it took to fight during the horrors of World War I and the kind of men that came out of that and the bravery that it took to do trench warfare. And I wonder if that had something to do with this press-on attitude.
It had everything to do with it. And when we look back on this remarkable risk that was taken to build R-100 or to build R-38, to try to fly R-34 across the Atlantic, to do all these things, we're looking at a different risk standard, people in the war, we're used to things blowing up and people dying, used to casualties on a mass scale, used to taking risks that we in our comfortable little suburban peaceful would never take. And, for example, a pilot in the, later on or in a non-war situation would probably be rewarded for not taking off into a storm. In this era, it was more likely that you'd be criticized for that. You would be expected to take off. There was a certain amount of not only tolerance for it, but desire for it, and feeling that that level of risk was normal. And it's one of the things that explains why airships, Zeppelins, persisted all those years, and why we can somehow scratch our heads and go, why would you fly something that would blow up like that?
And I think about. I can snicker a little, but I mean, we continually fly rockets to space and they don't always make it. So I wonder if there's still that maverick idea that's still out there today.
Yeah, well, there's always, someone like Chuck Yeager's greatest exploits were in peacetime. Well, I don't, you could, okay, he was one of the greatest fighter pilots in history, but we kind of know him for breaking the sound barrier, which was a peacetime activity. And we know you know, astronauts. Those were guys also who became famous in peacetime. So yes, I think the answer to that question is yes.
So you mentioned him, but I would like to bring back up the Right Honorable, and I have to read his titles, Christopher Birdwood Thompson, 1st Baron Thompson of Cardington, Privy Councillor, Commander of the British Empire, Peer of the House of Lords, officially Secretary of State of Ayr.
Of Ayr.
Yes. Also, very handily, friend of the Prime Minister.
Yes.
Champion of the R101. What? Why was that his baby?
Okay, so Thompson, and I love, oh, by the way, I love this, the Secretary of State for Ayr.
Yes,
it's so it's good. It's a Shakespearean title. He was a driving force. My story is yes, it's a story about all the technology that we've been talking about, but at base, it's a human story. And there are lots of human characters like Herbert Scott. And Thompson is the driver. Thompson is the guy who's going to drive this project to its grisly end. And it is his vision of a world populated by airships floating literally serenely over mountains in the Far East. And, you know, when you think of the British Empire, I mean, he was envisioning service from New Zealand and Australia and South Africa and India and Canada and, you know, Egypt. I mean, the world was going to be full of these long-range airships going everywhere. And he himself was an empire man. I mean, he was from five generations of one of the most influential stories of families in the Indian Raj, military families. He born in India. He was an empire man, I guess, at a time when I was saying before that the British Empire was a little bit wobbly. But he saw this vision that we could tie it together. We could bring it closer. We could sort of make it even more powerful by this particular solution. And R101 was his baby, because that was what was going to prove to the world that was going to work. And here's what Thompson wanted to do. Here's why this thing had to take off on October 4th. It shouldn't have. Why it had to take off on October 4th, 1934, India. What Thompson wanted to do was to fly that thing to India with him on board and 53 other unfortunate souls. And they were going to fly it to Karachi, which was then in India, 5,000 miles, one stop in Egypt, turn around, fly it back, 5,000 more miles, you know, an 8-day round trip, presumably. He was going to land the thing just north of London. He was going to walk off the airship trailing clouds of glory and walk into the Imperial Conference, which was the periodic gathering of all the grandees of empire, and just basically deliver this thundering speech about the future of air travel. That's what it was about. His vision, he pushed it along. He was going to see it through, and not coincidentally, he was going to get a whole bunch of money to build all these airships.
And he had a very famous girlfriend.
Yeah,
tell us about her.
Yes, there's always a woman. So the woman was actually one of the main things that drove him too. So when Christopher Birdwood Thompson, Lord Thompson of Cardington, was in the army during World War I, he was at one point military attaché in Bucharest in Romania, where he met a sort of fairy tale princess. Her name was Martha Bibesco, and she was immensely wealthy. She was, in fact, a real princess. So this was this girlfriend, kind of. Although early on, she couldn't have much time for him. She was having affairs with other very powerful men while still married to the prince. And he was always kind of trying to deserve her, because she was a person who was drawn to power, you know, the way flowers are drawn to sun. She was drawn to power, and he was an army lifer, kind of. So he does happen to be the Prime Minister of England's best friend, so he gets the job of the cabinet position. But he's always struggling to win her approval, and so going to India was very much part of that. Also, by that point, she'd come around, and she really was paying attention to him. And there was actually a third reason why he needed to go to India on that particular day. And this also had to do with impressing Martha, and it also had to do with what the time and distance ratio between England and India. He had been offered the job of Viceroy of India, which was the most powerful and important job in the British Empire, where he would rule over 300 million people. including 150,000 British subjects. He would live in a 200,000-square-foot, 340-room palace, which is the largest residence of any head of state in the world. And that was just the winter palace. The summer palace was in the Himalayas was quite nice, too. And, of course, he would have the most important job in the empire because the empire in India was seething. I mean, we had the rise of the Indian National Congress and Gandhi, and we know now that it only, 17 years left before independence. So the job would be to save India, where his entire family is from five generations back, for the British, impress Martha Bibesco. But also, if he has R101 flying back and forth, he now has, it's only 4 days between Europe and India, and so he's closer to the girlfriend.
Sam, Lord Thompson wanted to take 100 MPs on an experimental flight. Now, we're skipping ahead here. There's been significant delays. The press is not good about the ship in this hangar. So he wants to bolster the idea of this state of the air for Britain with 100 MPs on an experimental machine. Tell me about this.
Right. So one of the things that happened when they were building this ship was that they were very ambitious. They had this idea they were going to build because there were all these crashes and they knew about the crashes and they were going to kind of over engineer this. So this is going to be the safest thing ever. It was going to, as Thompson himself said, safe as a house except for the millionth chance. That's what he said. He called it an all weather aircraft. They became convinced that this thing really was great. I mean, great, strong, invulnerable almost. But the fact was it remained a largely untested experimental prototype. Now, an experimental prototype, you would kind of expect it to crash. Experimental prototypes are what they are. I mean, they haven't been tested yet because, you know, you don't become operational until you take that prototype and test it and test it and test it and test it again until you finally are sure that you could then take, but they didn't do this. And as a point of comparison, you know, it's great if, you know, Chuck Yeager goes up in the X-1. Okay. And there's an expectation that he may die or it may crash. In fact, it's a very high expectation. And all those test pilots back then went down, died in large numbers. Okay, that's what it is. That's what they do. So, but you don't put the Secretary of Defense in the back seat of the X-1, and you don't take 100 members of Parliament up. Meanwhile, that was just one particular moment when he tried and failed, fortunately for him, to do that. They had been taking everybody up on these joyrides as though this thing weren't dangerous. It's very, very, very dangerous. They didn't appreciate, you know, the level of risk that they were taking. But this particular story, he convinced everybody he was going to take 100 MPs, which was even more than the ship really could hold. If you add the 100 MPs to the crew, it was more weight than really the ship could handle. And the only thing that stopped it was a howling kind of a rainstorm with wind. And as it was, what they did is they took the 100 MPs and they put them in the airship at the mast and they didn't let it take off. I mean, it could very well have been one of the greatest. I mean, it was a substantial portion of the British government that would have gone down. But it reflects the attitude that this thing is invulnerable. It is reminiscent in some ways of an attitude in the building of the Titanic, which was two decades before.
Because his grasp of risk was dicey at best.
Was terribly faulty, and you know it. I mean, why did the designers of the Titanic decide that they didn't need to, you know, seal off the bulkheads between? Or, you know, why? I don't know, because they thought it was invulnerable. Why did Thompson want to do that? And in fact, taking the ship to India that night, which he shouldn't have done, was just another level of kind of not heeding the idea and not treating it as for what it was, which was this highly experimental prototype full of technologies that had never been used before, like diesel engines up in the air. No one had ever done that before, and all sorts of systems like that.
And the day it took off, the weather was dicey.
Very bad.
But he was excited about that.
Oh, yeah. His ambition, as he told Martha Bibesco at some point, was to ride the storm. He wanted to ride the storm. And this was his ambition. And he was he himself was fearless. But, I mean, maybe you don't want someone fearless in that situation. Maybe you want someone who's very afraid. Anyway.
You write that one does not need to be an aeronautical genius to know that the R101 is never going to get to Egypt or India. Why wasn't she airworthy?
I think the part of the book where I wrote that was when they made a horrible miscalculation on the amount of lift that she needed. They should have known. They didn't tell anyone, but that the thing was just way too heavy. You couldn't ever get there. And what they ended up doing was cutting it down the middle like a cucumber, opening it up and sticking a 500,000 cubic feet R bag or a gas bag in the middle of it, and then gluing it back together again. And then not testing it before they left. There were a number of moments. One in particular where the chief inspector. The chief airship inspector told them that the ship, he refused to certify it.
And is this McWade?
This is Frederick McWade, right? And this problem was that the gas bags, these enormous things, which were made out of cattle intestines, gold beater skins, were rubbing up against the interior girders, and the gas leakage was just so horrendous that he said, "I can't possibly certify this thing." He was slapped down and told to shut up, and that was really a month before our 101 took off.
So she takes off.
It's
terrible weather.
Yep.
She's flying low. What's her altitude? What's her speed?
The altitude that these things flew at surprises a lot of people and surprised me, which is the big rigids, if you were going to carry weight, you had to fly at 1,200 feet, which, think about a 770-foot aircraft, 777-foot aircraft flying at 1,000 feet or 1,100 feet. That's like once and a half its length. I mean, when people saw it go over London, they thought it was landing. So imagine if you applied those dimensions to a 747, it would be about a couple hundred feet off the ground. But the reason was, in order to carry weight, they had to have full hydrogen gas bags. And the only way you can do that was by flying low, because if the higher you went with a hydrogen gas bag, it would expand and then you would have to vent gas. So you lost lift as you went up. And it was the condition of these things. And everybody kind of accepted it as, yes, we were flying low and that's what we do and everything. But, what it meant was there was no margin for error. I mean, a 747 flying at 1,000 feet and something goes wrong, there's not a lot of room to correct it. An airship flying at the same height, there's just not a lot of room to correct something that goes wrong. And it was a condition. It was one of the, there's so many things that made them vulnerable, the wind and hydrogen and everything else. But the idea that they had to fly low was one of them.
And she was slow. That surprised me.
Oh, yeah.
I guess I'm used to air travel now.
Barely hit 60 miles an hour in the 50s. So it wasn't although speed, if you're going to India, the speed doesn't matter. I mean, even if you average 55 miles an hour, as long as you can stay up and continuously travel at 55 miles an hour, airplanes couldn't do that.
And you mentioned this a little, but her cover over her gas bags was patches on patches at this point.
Yes, everything was patched and patched again, and didn't pass inspection. And the book, in one sense, is a chronicle of folly. I guess it's a story. I mean, it's a story about how Christopher Thompson, drove R101 to her death. But it's also just a story about human folly on a gigantic scale, and that goes back to the early Zeppelins, which crashed and then were the worst kind of weapons of all in World War One.
So 101, she gets to France. It's night, right?
She crosses the channel.
What happens next?
We know that she crashes because it's on the cover of my book. But she, so it's, well, what happens is she goes down about 90 miles north of Paris. It would be a kind of a spoiler, I guess, to go into great detail about that. But what I can tell you, though, is that that because there were six survivors, it was a miracle that they survived, because there were, it enables me to narrate the end, I think, in a pretty complete way. Exactly what happens when it goes into the dives, and then what happens when it hits the ground. It is a hydrogen fireball that looks exactly like the Hindenburg fireball, which, by the way, I've mentioned the Hindenburg a few times, and my book isn't about the Hindenburg,
no.
But the Hindenburg is the marker in all of our minds about Zeppelins. I mean, you look at the first the cover of Led Zeppelin's first album, for example, which is the picture of the Hindenburg. But it's the marker that we all know. And that was 1937. It was 7 years later. R101 was more lethal. R101 is a much better story, to my way of thinking, than the Hindenburg. But the Hindenburg offered this look at what a hydrogen, what a ship looks like when a spark hits its hydrogen. And this happened dozens and dozens and dozens of times, giant fireballs during World War I. They were, England people were watching these things fall out of the sky, and they all looked like the Hindenburg, and R101 looked like the Hindenburg. And the difference was that, and that's why the Hindenburg is not only a good kind of marker, because we all know it, but it shows you what it looked like when these things went up.
And I thought it was interesting, your description, that it was more of a crunch, not a crash, when they went down.
Right, because it hits the ground, because if you have a ship that it can only go 60 miles an hour and it's flying dead, almost dead into a 40 to 50 mile an hour wind, your ground speed is not very high. I mean, we're talking maybe 25 miles an hour ground speed into the wind. So it's not a crash the way we would think of an airliner today, of a 737 crashing into the ground, which would be at very high speeds. This was at a low-speed crash. So.
And I don't want to give too much away. We do know it crashes, but I thought this was just so poignant that we know that Chief Coxswain Skye Hunt says, "We're down, lads." Do we know?
That was the great mystery of R101,
yeah.
which has been a mystery until a paper came out in 2017 that nobody read, but you can read my book and you can find out what happened to R101 when he says that. He says this strange thing. The ship goes into two dives, but after the first dive, when the ship is not down on the ground at all, he makes the statement that we're down. And for years, nobody had any idea what he could possibly mean, because they weren't down. They were still several hundred feet off the ground. It's a bit complicated, which is mainly why I feel like I shouldn't go into it now. It would take me half an hour. But that mystery is solved, and it was actually solved by this genius British researcher, and not that long ago. And again, a paper that no one read. So I feel like I'm privileged to bring Brian Lawton's paper and his solution, which is brilliant, and which the airship community now accepts as the reality, to the story.
How devastating was this for the British public?
This was the biggest outpouring of national grief since the Titanic, almost 18 years before. It was astounding, the level of national grief. And I say astounding because they had just come out of a war, well, not just, but relatively recently come out of a war where 750,000 people died. And we're talking, you know, there were 54 people on this airship. There was something about, maybe I don't know exactly what it is. It gets back to the engineering and ideology thing. There was something about these giant ships that tugged at national heartstrings that went deeper than it would appear. It may have been just the colossal ambition of the thing. It may have been the colossal size. There's something Titanic, literally outsized about the ambition. But yeah, they had, I mean, hundreds of thousands of people in London lined the streets. Somebody estimated the crowd at a million, full houses at Westminster and St. Paul's cathedrals. This was a big deal. It was one of the first mass media events in world history. Newspapers everywhere, radio stations now operating, wireless radios around the world. It was just this absolutely massive thing and a really big part of British history. And now forgotten. So part of, I think, the fun for me in this book anyway was to bring this story out, because it is, whatever overrode it, whether it was the rise of, whether it was someone like Lindbergh or the rise of heavier than air machines and the dominance of airplanes and not airships, it is largely forgotten. So,
how did Martha take Lord Thompson's death?
Oh yeah, she had a weird premonition the night before. The night it happened, it was one of those, we hear about these things where somebody sits upright in bed, right at the time that it crashes. She had one of those and wept for days, and she was in Europe at that point, but she wasn't there. She didn't make it to the funeral, but she ended up coming later, she visited the graves, which were and she visited the site of the crash later, and curiously, in December of that year, the airship crashed on October 5th. In December of that year, she received a dozen red roses from Thompson, who had, the last thing he did before he got in the airship was to arrange for a florist to deliver these to her at Christmas, which, you know, with all of his love. So it was his last act was long after his death.
My guest this hour has been journalist Essie Gwynn, author of the book His Majesty's Airship, The Life and Tragic Death of the World's Largest Flying Machine. Sam, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. This has been great.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram and subscribe to our podcast for free wherever you get your podcast. Just search for KERA Think. You can also get the podcast on our website where you can find out about upcoming shows. That's at think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Paige Phelps in for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.